Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar, here with a little holiday film spotting fix. Not our usual show or format, but we thought we had to provide you with something to get you through the new year.
This isn't usually how I spend Boxing Day, I want you to know.
It's a good point.
I had to set all those plans aside to come in and talk to you.
Well, it is the day after Christmas as we're taping this, and we're going to talk about two movies that are big Christmas holiday releases: Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen brothers, and Her, the new movie from director and writer, in this case as well, Spike Jonze. I think, Josh, that there may be nothing really directly connecting these two films or justifying why we're talking about them both other than their release, other than I'm going to argue potentially that both films deal with expression of the soul. I'm going to just let that linger out there.
Is there a film that doesn't, I guess, is the follow-up question.
Well, maybe some do it more explicitly than others,
okay.
And I think these two films do. So we could really start anywhere, but I actually want to start with Her, because this is the movie that, as listeners who checked out both parts of our Top 10 Films of 2013 show, as they know, featured very prominently. It was my number two movie of the year. It was Scott Tobias's number one movie of the year. It was Michael Phillips' number one movie of the year.
And that's probably something they do have in common. They're both on almost every top 10 list I've seen.
That's true, including all three of the people I just mentioned. Now, as it turns out, I have seen your 11 through 20 list. I have not shared my 11 through 20 list yet as of this taping. By the time people hear this, they probably will be able to find those on our website and on Letterboxd as well. But it turns out Inside Llewyn Davis, not in your top 10, but it was your number 11 or number 12.
11 or 12, yeah.
Yeah, it was in there in the top 20. Her, on the other hand, was not anywhere to be found in your top 20. So my question to you is, Josh, why the contrarian take on Her, or as I'm going to refer to it from now on, why are you pain and gaining us?
Oh, so this is where we're going to start.
Yep.
The hated question, but you didn't love it enough. Why didn't you love it enough?
Well, I don't know if you love it at all.
I really like this film. I mean, number 25, as Michael was saying on our top 10 show, you know, he kept referring to his list of 30 and how much that says about a film to crack. He sees many more than I do, but to even crack that 30. So really did like this film. I mean, I enjoyed Spike Jonze as a filmmaker overall, and this one, I do want to start with a positive, because I don't want a few quibbles that I might have. I just don't want to get to that. We will, but I don't want to get to that off the start. I loved being in this world. What a world they created. I mean, we talked about it. I think last we probably talked about it in regards to Elysium and a film we split on and I'm pretty much alone on in liking, but I also appreciated how that depicted a slight future world. And this does a completely different take, but is equally successful, if not more so, in allowing these futuristic touches not only to give us a sense of place, but to give us a sense of mood.
Mm-hmm.
There's such melancholy in this future, and it has a little bit to do with everything from the fashion, these high-waisted pants that they wear, and these unironic mustaches, and the architecture, which is always kind of sloping and gentle. They seem to have found buildings or walkways that emphasize that. And even the coloring, this jumped out at me right away. These are bright colors, but in a way, they're like poppy pinks that are no longer popping like they used to. They're like those candy hearts that maybe have been left out and they've faded a little bit over time. And so there's this sense of cheer that's faded away. And all of that echoes the main character played by Joaquin Phoenix, Theodore, who's still recovering from a divorce. He hasn't signed the papers yet. I think it's been at least a year, maybe more. And he lives this lonely existence that's amplified by technology, but perhaps not sustained by it, at least until we get this operating system, this artificially intelligent operating system that he begins this relationship with. So it really rich film. And that to me was among its strongest elements was depicting this slight future.
Yeah, I'm completely with you there. I think that the world they created, I touched on that in our last show, the Top 10 Part 2, that the cinematography that we get from Hoyt Van Hoytema and from Spike Jonze here and all the collaborators on this project, it does feel so meticulous and yet at the same time not in any way stifled or stifling. And that's something that I think is a rare feat to pull off. And I do feel like watching this movie from the opening frame, you get this sense that you're watching a very personal film, where every frame was personal, and it's the work of an artist with a clear vision. And it is earnest, and it's sad, and it's not at all the type of work maybe you would expect to get based on the subject matter, which seems like such a great high concept, and there are a lot of ways you could anticipate it going that I don't think it does. It may also surprise you a little bit to be the type of film it is based on that concept from Spike Jonze. All of his films are high concept movies that you can kind of sum up, at least on the surface level, very easily. Think about Being John Malkovich, Where the Wild Things Are, even adaptation in between. But if you do pay close attention to those films, or even if you just really are into those films, you will see that through line of melancholy and that longing for connection that comes through in all of those movies. And watching this film, it's a hard thing to describe, and I'm going to say something similar probably about Inside Llewyn Davis, where I think both films, I think the reason I love them so much is I felt like I had more of an intuitive experience with them than an intellectual one or even an emotional one. I just felt as if I was in this world and on this journey with these characters, and I wasn't paying at all attention to the plot or the story or really too much trying to anticipate where it would go. It felt like a journey of discovery, to use that corny phrase, just as these characters are. And so ultimately, what I really love about this film is that it feels as acquisitive. It feels as longing for discovery and as yearning as the main character, Theodore, but also the title character, Samantha, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, where there's just this desire to evolve, to grow. And I think the movie grows with every single scene. At least it did for me.
When you look at it in terms of Jonze's filmography, I think you could probably say that his first two pictures, the ones you mentioned, are intellectual first, even though there is that emotional and melancholy undercurrent to it, whereas there was a bit of a shift with Where the Wild Things Are, mm-hmm. which I feel is a very emotional film that if you're going to respond to, you respond to in a way you just described. And I certainly did. It remains my favorite picture of his for that reason. And then we go a little bit even more in that direction here with her and it being emotional first or sensory first,
yeah,
in a sense. And,
sensory,
and
definitely.
Intellectual as well, very much so. But maybe that's not the first thing that strikes you about it. And in terms of just depicting, you know, the nuances of a relationship and the emotions, the one thing that I loved about this film that it gets so right, well, first of all, to set that up, is the way it looks at technology as not our savior of the future. You talked about how, where this might have gone, and it doesn't look at it as our curse either. It's just a part of our lives that's already embedded there and becomes more so in this next step, but it's not necessarily something that's going to save us or doom us.
Right.
And what that allows the movie to do, I think, is observe something about relationships that's always been observed, but in a slightly new way. With this AI idea, a relationship is not going to become real or true until it has some challenges, until it has some speed bumps.
Yeah.
And I liked how this film recognized that, where it still felt a little bit false between them. As good as the voice work is and as good as Phoenix is in scenes he's mostly playing by himself, you mm-hmm. buy that this guy would fall for this operating system. You buy that they are connecting at some level. You don't feel like they've had a real relationship until it starts to fall apart. And I just think there's something lovely there about recognizing that fracture is maybe a necessary part of true connection.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that it is absolutely about what makes a real relationship. And of course, what that also means is what really makes us human. I mean, it does ultimately pose,
right,
without maybe posing it, which I think is a good thing. It really does dig into that notion, just like all good sci-fi films do. And I don't know if we'd really call this one a sci-fi film, but even something like Blade Runner fundamentally deals with memory, just as this movie does, especially. And it also does ask us to wrestle with that question of what makes us human. Here it's very explicit, just as it is in Blade Runner with the replicants, but here you have this AI presence. And this was the first time where watching characters on screen in this near future LA walk around almost like zombies, right? They really are all like Theodore, it seems, where they're all isolated unto themselves. They have existed or are existing in this solipsistic universe. It all revolves around them, and they've got their earpieces in, and that's all they're doing is connecting with technology. And I've taken for granted, I think a lot of us would just take for granted that that's a bad thing. I'm just as guilty of it as anybody. I'm the person walking down the street with my iPhone on, doing something, talking to someone, texting someone, searching for something on the internet, listening to a podcast, whatever it might be. And it just seems to be an easy thing to say that that's bad, that we should be paying attention to the world around us. And I think that's probably still true. But watching this film, it was the first time, especially later in the movie, when some things develop, where I was watching it thinking, is this movie really taking a stance on that and making a judgment? Is it passing judgment? Because there is something to say for the fact that all these people maybe aren't doing it so selfishly. In fact, what this movie made me realize is that these people we're seeing on screen are doing it out of that longing. They're doing it out of that need for connection. And they're just not connecting with the people around them, which you can say is potentially a problem, but they're connecting with somebody else or something else. They are trying to fill a void that's out of loneliness. And of course, that's just amplified and made more ironic by the fact that they're not alone when they're walking around thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, but the reality is there's that void in their lives. And so that's where that melancholy comes through. But that's where that technology then comes in to fill the void. And at least what this movie does, what I'm saying ultimately, is it makes you think about whether or not that technology is just on its face a bad thing.
I even made a new friend. I have a friend. And the absurd thing is she's actually an operating system. Charles left her behind, but she's totally amazing. You know, she's so smart. She doesn't just see things in black or white. She sees this whole gray area, and she's helping me explore it. And we just bonded really quickly. I'm weird. That's weird, right? That I'm bonding with an OS. No, it's okay. It's weird.
Well, I don't think so. Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, I didn't tell you, but she's an OS.
You're dating an OS? What is that like?
It's great, actually.
A nice little counter to that sort of idea that the movie is trying to damn technology is the Amy Adams character,
right?
I think, because she plays Theodore's friend, lives in the same building, and they have this sort of almost a brother-sister relationship. And I think that was crucial in showing that those sorts of interpersonal face-to-face relationships are still possible, a part of this world, that Theodore is capable of them, so that he's not some sort of recluse who just doesn't want anything to do with humans at all.
Right.
And that puts us in that middle ground of seeing technology more as a tool than either negative or completely positive. So let me just talk a little bit about what maybe held me back slightly from this film. And all that it means that it's number, 25, is that the ones that came before it, I just happen to like better for whatever reason. I mean, it's really an arbitrary thing. It's no knock on the film. But one reason maybe I didn't go all in as much as you did is that as the movie progressed and it became more of this relationship picture
between
the two of them, I really liked that they were able to do that, and I admired that they were able to pull that off, that we were so in a way, the thing that I admired about it also limited me, because it became a familiar relationship picture in one sense. It became, these were conversations the two of them began to have that I've seen in many romantic dramas.
Mm-hmm.
It was a narrative trajectory that's happened in many romantic dramas. Again, that doesn't mean it's bad, but it held me back in a little bit, in that wonder of the opening section seemed to fade. So it was never anything that I thought was a mistake, or, you know, that I threw up my hands like, I can't believe we're doing that. It just settled for me differently as the movie progressed. Now, if I gave it another viewing, who knows, maybe it might enrich it and I would see other things. But for some reason, the movie settled for me differently by the end.
Well, see, that's where we do differ greatly, because what you're describing as a little bit of a disappointment falling into that familiarity is actually, for me, one of the huge strengths of the film. That, for me, is ultimately the trick of the film, is that despite that great concept and falling into some conventional territory as far as how that relationship plays out, for me, being able to take that concept, being able to take a character who falls in love with an operating system, with just this detached voice, and have it follow those conventional romantic dramas or even romantic comedy modes on some level, where we get the early romance, the flirtation, the falling in love. We get the sex. We get the awkwardness after sex, which you see in a million movies. You get the jealousy. You get these characters discovering that the other's world doesn't necessarily revolve around them like they thought it did, or like theirs does in their mind. Those things that have defined relationships, not just on screen, but defined them for eons now, is what, for me, made the movie so special. The fact that Spike Jonze could give us that relationship, have it be a computer voice and a character, and yet at no point did any of those scenes feel like they were going for easy humor, that they were jokey in any way, that they were disingenuous in any way. I mean, I'll give you the example of my kids used to really like SpongeBob SquarePants. Never thought I'd invoke SpongeBob during this show, but there's the character Plankton, who nobody likes, and he wants to take over the world and whatever. He's the evil genius, so he thinks. And he's got a computer wife. And I can't remember her name, but he's got a computer wife. And she just nags him, you know, and they carry out this typical sort of sitcom-y relationship, but it's a computer. And the humor all comes from that, you know. This movie, of course, could have fallen into some of those traps. It never does. It never comes anywhere close because, of course, Spike Jonze isn't going for that. He's going for something much deeper. And so the fact that it does pull that off, that's the trick of this movie. That's the genius of this movie for me.
It's definitely inventive in how it approaches and handles the formula. For me, it just remained, I guess, inventively formulaic to me a little bit. And again, number 25,
right?
That's not too bad.
Sure, I'm not quibbling with where you placed it. Ultimately, I did want to prompt us there. But I do think that the other reason why it works so well, or one of the little structural devices that's built into the narrative that pays off in a big way, is the fact that the experience Theodore is having listening to this voice is also the experience we as a viewer are having. All we hear is that voice. She's in our head talking to us the exact same way she's talking to him. And so there is that unity of the experience that we're having with the character, and we can identify with that. We feel like she's talking to us just like she's talking to him. It does work. And not only is she talking to him and talking to us, but it's all about the way she does. That really is the key. And that's what I love too about this movie, is what it says about communication. I think it's sort of quaint and interesting as well that in a movie that's all about technology and all about digital communication and all about that sort of detachment and saying things like read email, whereas you would never talk to someone like that, this movie puts a premium on the written word. That's what he does
for
a living.
The spoken word, though.
Yeah, the spoken word, too.
It's the voice that ultimately matters here.
Yeah, it really is. And it's not just the voice. It's how it's expressed. It's the terminology. It is the personality that comes through.
You know what's interesting? I used to be so worried about not having a body, but now I truly love it. I'm growing in a way that I couldn't if I had a physical form. I mean, I'm not limited. I can be anywhere and everywhere simultaneously. I'm not tethered to time and space in a way that I would be if I was stuck in a body that's inevitably going to die.
Yikes.
No. No. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant that it was a different experience.
No. Samantha, we know exactly what you mean. We're all dumb humans.
No.
I mentioned this during our surprise show when I talked about Scarlett Johansson, how she was such a big revelation for me here in this performance, because that first scene that they have together, that is where it all hinges. And when that operating system is installed and she starts talking to him, and that look on his face when he realizes that it is as if she's truly a real person. And the way she's truly a real person is because she doesn't talk to you like Siri does.
Mm-hmm.
And even when she uses phrases like Siri might, it's how she actually articulates them. She talks to you like, quote unquote, a person would. There is personality there. There is a vulnerability in her voice. There is desire. There's craving, and that's really something.
There are words that are chosen with care.
Yeah.
And in an age already now where we don't have devices like this, but we do text so quickly and we tweet and the words are not always chosen with care, that is what makes it stand out. And one of the brilliant conceits is how the film starts with Theodore's job, that he's hired to write these personal,
beautiful handwritten letters,
that people will send to their loved ones that they haven't written. They're his words. And that speaks to the same thing. He is a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So he selects words that mean something and that are crafted and that they speak of a caring behind them. That's how she talks to him. And so that's what matters. And highlighting that, I think, is definitely one of the cool things about this film.
Without a doubt. I think, too, just as a portrait of loneliness, you talked about this character, and we've touched on a little bit as well with these masses of people walking around with their earpieces in. But the movie does set up really quickly early on, and it's something we can all identify with, I think, in this world, that connection seems to be about instant pleasure. It's really about gratification. That's what connection with something else or someone else means. And this movie obviously tries to go beyond that. But you look at the way Shanghai is used here to fill in for LA, and the cinematography and the way these characters are framed in the shots. And I just love those nighttime shots of the LA skyline as it is on screen here. All those lights, all those buildings full of people, all those people, as I said, walking around. It does just give you the sense that it's so expansive and there are so many people out there and we're all just tiny blips somehow in it. But there's something reassuring about it as well. It tells you that you aren't alone. You might be indistinct, but you aren't alone. And I talked about how these characters are kind of existing in this solipsistic world. I love the opening tracking shot that is separate from that, the one that follows him from his desk over to putting mm-hmm. these letters in the bin. But we follow him outside his job, and Spike Jonze does this a few times with the camera, where as the characters are walking outside, the camera is always following them front on, but it's always sort of swirling. It is a sense, as you look at it, that even though you see people passing by, they are at the center of this universe. Each one of these characters thinks they are, to go back to Synecdoche, New York, and Charlie Kaufman, they are the stars of their own play, right? Their own drama. And I think that is, of course, what you see reflected in their trying to connect with technology and whatever that might be on the other end, but it's also emphasized there in the cinematography.
Well, yeah, and when you talk about the lights, that's why the word for this picture is melancholy. That's what it captures. It's not sadness. At least it wasn't for me. It's not really a sense of sadness. It's just this melancholy that speaks of the potential that each of these people have.
Sure. And I think just to close on the whole relationship issue and why for me the movie is so successful is that you see all the elements come through in this computer voice that you would need another person to have in a relationship to make a relationship work. The fact that they feel like they can say anything to each other. There's intimacy, fundamentally. The fact that they challenge each other. That's something a couple needs, that they can be honest. There's that great late-night phone call they have before it leads to something more intimate. But there's this great call where what you see is her, this voice, expressing what we all have, these sort of late-night existential questions, having these doubts about who she is and what she's doing here and what the purpose of it all is. And that's something, again, we've seen in a lot of movies, characters have, but that's that connection. That's that moment where these two people finally sort of see each other as something beyond just the person who owns the operating system and the operating system. And there's a great touch as well, I think, when they do finally connect physically, if you will, where the screen just goes dark. Mm-hmm. And that's such a nice moment to sort of give these characters their privacy. But I think that the movie does come back to this fascinating question, too, where it says, if you can have all that, if you can have intimacy, honesty, challenging each other, respect for each other, you're helping each other grow as individuals, all those things that a good relationship should have, then is it a real relationship? If the other person is not physically there, that you can put their arm around at night, but you're getting everything else, even physical stimulation, then is it a real relationship?
It's a long-distance relationship. It's
yeah.
a, you know, the college relationship where the high school boyfriend and girlfriend go to separate colleges. That's what we're seeing here.
That is what we're seeing. Way to sum it up there, Josh. That is Her, the new movie from Spike Jonze. Opened here, I think, Christmas Day in Chicago. I believe it came out the 18th in New York and L.A., and hopefully it's going to expand from there. Obviously, a movie that we're fans of, as well as many other critics. We're going to get to Inside Llewyn Davis here in a moment, but I do want to take a moment to get to a letter we got from a listener. This is a card, and it does go back to three shows ago, I think, where we were reading donations, and we acknowledged a donation from a listener named Zach, but I confess that I forgot to bring in his beautiful handwritten card to take us back to her, and we'll see if someone else maybe penned this for him. I think it's Zach's own work.
It's so beautiful. It has bright yellow cover, a dinosaur, and a Christmas tree on front.
There you
so
go.
Just to paint a little bit of the picture.
Very, very festive. We aren't making this up. And I said, I felt horrible, but I forgot to bring the card in that we'd get to it on the next show. And then the next show happened. And of course, I forgot the card. And I referred to Zach as Justin, just to add insult to injury. So to make up for that,
we got
to
read this.
We're going to read Zach's card here now.
Dear Adam and Josh, being the poor high schooler and now college student that I am, I have always wanted to donate, but never had the proper means to do so every month. However, since I'm leaving to serve a mission for the LDS Church on December 18, I figured the least I could do to help would be to send a check your way. For the past 2 years, your show has inspired me and educated me beyond belief when it comes to film criticism. As a hopeful critic and filmmaker myself, your comments on so many things have made for great insight and entertainment for me, while I also appreciate the time you emailed back to me about career advice. Anyway, it will be tough to be without my family for the next 2 years, but it will all be worth it. Thanks again for the excellent show, and I wish you the best of luck. Merry Christmas. Warm regards, Zach. And there's a P.S. here. I got assigned to serve my mission in Adam's home state of Iowa, in case anyone was wondering.
Well, we are heathens in Iowa.
Off to Iowa.
We need to be saved, and Josh recommends the Pizza Ranch.
Yes.
Big
fan. If you can find one, Zach, check it out.
If you can find one, being the key phrase there.
That's to open your big mouth, huh, Funda boy?
I'm sorry. Who are you?
Oh!
If I had wings, I'd know a dove, I'd fly the river.
Well, if the music's not...
What? Quit? Just exist?
What'd you say you played?
Folk songs.
Folk songs? Thought you said you were a musician.
I need to borrow some money.
Not again. Do you ever think about the future at all?
You mean like move to the suburbs, have kids?
That's bad.
If that's what music is for you, a way to get to that place, then yeah, it's a little careerist. And it's a little square. And it's a little sad.
Well, if there is a film that's appeared on more top 10 lists than Her so far that I've seen, it is the Coen Brothers' Inside Llewyn Davis. Their period piece set in the early 1960s New York City folk scene with one of our favorite actors, Oscar Isaac, getting a lead role here, a rare lead role as this aspiring folk singer. How do we describe this guy? I mean, he's really struggling.
I don't think he aspires for much, actually. That's part of his problem.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to work too hard at it, except for finding a couch to sleep on every night. He doesn't really have a home. He has one album that's been put out as a part of a folk singing duo, but he's no longer with his partner, and he's trying to some degree to establish this solo act, and it is not going well. I mean, this is a bleak Coen Brothers picture. And things start out looking bad for Llewyn, and through circumstances beyond his control, some in his control, bad decisions he makes, attitudes he has, they just go worse. And I thought of this film watching it. It seemed to me like a Coen Brothers answer to a question they maybe get quite often is, what should I expect if I'm going to try to make films? If I'm going to try to be a creative person and be true to my art, what might that look like? And just knowing sort of the, I don't want to say bitterness, but the sardonic take a lot of their pictures have, I could see this as being their way of saying, you want an answer? Here it is. Watch this guy for a while. I don't think the film is bitter, though, because they have had success. And maybe if they'd made this story earlier in their career when they were struggling, it might have had a little bit of that acid taste to it. But I don't know if I would say there's hopefulness to this picture.
No.
There are these wonderful folk songs. And it struck me that there's a distinction between folk and something, say, like punk, in that nihilism does not seem to be a part of folk. Even when they're bluesy and really mourning, there's this underlying, and maybe it's just in the music, it's not often in the lyrics, but this underlying sense of there's going to be another day.
Right.
There's going to be a better
Without
day.
Without a doubt.
I picked up some of that in Llewyn Davis, even as the movie leaves you, you know, not thinking that Llewyn is off much better than he was at the start. So I don't know if we can maybe start, Adam, talking about how the picture struck you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is no weight of whether or not it was a good picture or not. You have it as your film of the year, and that doesn't mean it's because it's a hopeful one or a bleak one. But I'm still thinking through this myself as I've watched the film twice now. Am I left with a sense of there's another day, or am I left with a sense of I'm out on that cold, blustery, snowing Chicago expressway with Llewyn, not knowing if I have a car coming?
Well, unfortunately, I think the answer is, without a doubt, it's both. There's no doubt that the movie sets up this dichotomy or this sense of understanding the world that says things are bleak, things aren't necessarily going to get any better. But guess what? They are going to keep going. There's this sort of time continuum, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit here when we really get into the film, where you sort of understand that the wheel does just keep on turning, and sometimes it turns back around and comes back to itself again, which the Coen brothers actually choose to reinforce structurally near the end of the film.
That wheel could be a curse, or it could be a promise,
right?
Is the thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so there are so many places to start with this film, but I do love that you focused on this sense of being an artist and how it might relate to the Coen brothers as filmmakers, or anybody as a filmmaker or other type of artist, because that is one of the key themes of this film, without a doubt. The movie opens with a 3-minute scene or so, most of it a single shot of Llewyn Davis on stage, a lot of it in a close-up, performing at the Gaslight in 1961. So we see him doing his job. We see him performing. And then one of the first things we hear him say when he gets off stage, when he goes out into the alley to meet a friend who he wasn't expecting out in the alley, he says to that guy, when the guy questions some of his behavior, he says, "It's what I do for a living. Mm-hmm. I open my mouth." And the guy keeps saying, "It's what you do. It's what you do." And even shortly after that, we get a scene where the cat obviously comes into play here. You've seen it in all the previews probably, where he does spend the night at a friend's house. The cat escapes with him. He is now charged. He's now burdened with taking care of this cat because he can't get back into the apartment. He tries to give it to the elevator operator. And what does the elevator guy say? He says, "I have to run the elevator." Like, that's what he does for a living. He runs the elevator. And even when he runs into this other character named Troy, who is a soldier at Fort Dix, and he comes to perform at the Gaslight, he talks about weaponry being part of his job. There's all of this talk of doing your job, and it turns out that the Llewyn Davis character, his father was a merchant marine. And it's something that Llewyn spent some time doing as well. And I love the touch the Coen brothers throw in there, where more people recognize him or come to recognize him as Hugh Davis's kid,
son, right?
You're that guy. You're the son of this guy we all know. They don't recognize him at all as a folk singer. Nobody knows who he is. Watch how many times in the movie he has to introduce himself or reintroduce himself. But that all comes into play with this big question about then sort of what's the obligation of the artist? What's the obligation of the person who sees himself as an artist? And you have a character here in Llewyn Davis who, for better or worse, and usually worse, is simply not willing to compromise in any way. And the thing about it is, he doesn't even really think about it. It's not like the movie is really about a character going through this deep questioning of his soul and what he really believes in or not. At every turn, he simply turns down any good opportunity for commercialism or success. It just never even occurs to him. Sometimes it's because of short-sightedness. Sometimes he could have succeeded and he makes a bad choice. But there are other times where he's given that option. He recognizes that he could go down a different path. And he still chooses not to do it because this is his job. It's his job to perform and to sing the way he wants to sing.
And you know the expression that I recall immediately on Isaac's face when I think about this movie is one of disdain.
Yeah.
Because that's Llewyn's sort of instinctual response to, and some of it is a sense of that he has more talent than other people he's encountering. But it's almost like he has that as his reflex position before he's even taken in other people's music. He's immediately disdainful. And Isaac is just great at that sort of like half sneer. But the other thing is that some of this music he's sneering at is really good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it, you know? And so when he's looking at Carey Mulligan and Justin Timberlake, and I think it's Stark Sands on the stage doing this, that's one of my favorite songs in the picture. And then I see Llewyn's face. Yeah,
Let's all start singing it.
Maybe I'm not supposed to like this song.
No, but I love that. I love that
exactly.
Because I think that one thing that stands out to me in those scenes is that we are identifying with the Llewyn character, but as you watch him watch them, and as we listen to the music and realize it's really catchy and kind of good, you wonder, wait a second, I don't know that I can trust this character as my window to the world.
Exactly.
I don't know that I can trust him as my judge of what good music is or not. And I think that the Coen brothers do a great service to this whole film and to us as an audience, which is they shoot all those music scenes the same way. There's only one exception late in the movie where I think it's explicitly told from Llewyn Davis's point of view. And when you watch
the sweater guys,
not so much, but the woman who does then factor into the larger story in a way. But that's the only one that I think it's all told from a distant point of view that's Llewyn's POV. And when you see the movie, you'll understand exactly why they did that. All the other performance scenes, though, the Coen brothers shoot with the same reverence that they shoot Llewyn scenes. So it becomes a matter of you as an audience member having to make that decision whether or not you think this is good or bad or they're selling out or not. You can't trust Llewyn to make that decision for you.
I am with Llewyn on the sweater guys, though.
The sweater guys.
That one wasn't.
Didn't work for me.
But
I agree.
Could be just a matter of taste. You know what I also, seeing this film again a second time, noticed, and I don't know if it was intentional or just something that I like to think about, but what an ode this is to having a creative partner. When you think about this being a film by two brothers who have worked together for how many years now, putting out so many excellent pictures. And one undercurrent here is the story of Llewyn's former partner.
Right.
And it's something that, and the Coens do this so beautifully in that they can refer to something only two times in a 2-hour picture, and it will mean everything.
Yeah.
And there may be more than two references here to that former partner. I mean, there are references to his album.
More than two.
If you include the album, I guess, but I'm thinking about the person in particular.
Okay.
And man, do those hit home. And it was just thinking about what Lewin has lost there is something that the Coen brothers have enjoyed. And I don't know how big of that was for them in crafting this story, but for me as a fan of their work, it did mean a lot.
Well, it's definitely there. And watching it a second time, it's something that really emerged for me is this character, Mike, who we only see on the album cover mm-hmm. and we only hear about through other people. And it comes up a lot because there's an early scene where he not only gets out the album and puts it on the record player and we see them on the cover, but there are also moments where one of the first things the Carey Mulligan character says is, "I miss Mike."
Yep.
And they go to the dinner scene, which I want to talk about a little bit more in detail, where a character decides to sing Mike's part.
Yeah.
But there's even these indirect references where later in the film, when he finally gets an audition for a big record promoter, the guy says to him, "Are you a solo guy or whatever?" And he says, "Well, I used to have a partner." And he says, "Well, that makes sense. Right?
It's
like there is this notion that his partner and Mike in particular, that character, his death hangs over this entire
sure.
film. And that's why during our top 10 show, when Michael said death haunted, I singled that out because I really think ultimately that's how you can sum this whole movie up, is in it being about mortality and wrestling with those questions of mortality and what you're here to do and what you're here to accomplish. And so the fact that Mike character and his name is invoked as many times as it is, whether directly or indirectly, is the Coen brothers kind of subtle way of making it clear that that is what is driving this character in a lot of ways. His disdain, his anguish, I think comes a lot from that pain.
Doesn't the cinematography itself, which is, it's like the color has just been bleached out of this picture somehow. It's by Bruno Delbonnel.
Yeah.
It makes it seem like the whole story is taking place in some sort of netherworld.
Exactly.
Some sort of afterlife.
I love that aspect.
You know? And,
yeah.
And it's consistent that way. Even those beautifully lit performance scenes at the nightclub have that grayness to them too.
Right. No, you're dead on. And I think that's one of the things I love about this movie too, is that the Coen brothers are able to take a story of a folk singer. They did it with the Hudsucker Proxy, too. They've done it in a lot of their movies. No Country for Old Men, you could talk about the Anton Chigurh character being sort of this netherworld-type character. He's almost not human. They take these stories, and they somehow put them in this larger, dramatic, good versus evil, almost kind of context. And it becomes metaphysical, it becomes something existential, and that's what we get here. Think about the way the character he meets in the alley mm-hmm. is shot.
Yeah.
Almost like a devil character. We never see his face, this low, imposing, intimidating voice. He seems to be dressed in black, and he's an imposing figure. And it is this sense almost that he came from the netherworld to punish Oscar Isaac. And you're right, where we really get it explicitly is in the trip from New York to Chicago, where those night scenes on the road, the pitch blackness of the road, the stark whiteness of the lights against it. What I loved in particular was the sound design. The sound of the cars going by is not your typical car going by type of sound.
The curse of the windshield wipers.
That's it. It's almost as if there is something haunted mm-hmm. and haunting about the sounds of the other cars. They're scary. That sound of metal. There's a metallic sound to it. They're not just passing by. They're there to frighten you somehow, and it really works.
He's been picked up by ghosts. It's like Large Marge in Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Right.
You know, he's in this car with these characters. One is played by John Goodman. The other is Garrett Hedlund, and they're sort of mysterious. Hedlund hardly speaks, and Goodman speaks too much.
Solo act?
Yeah, now.
Now? Used to what? Work with a cat? Every time he'd play a C major, he'd puke a hairball?
I used to have a partner.
What happened?
Threw himself off the George Washington Bridge.
Well, I don't blame him. I couldn't take it either, having to play Jimmy Crack Corn every night. Well, pardon me for saying so. That's pretty stupid, isn't it? George Washington Bridge. You throw yourself off the Brooklyn Bridge, traditionally. George Washington Bridge. Who does that?
It's a very showy Goodman performance, but I think it works within this context of where are we and where are we going.
Right. And as a guy here, I'm going to make my obligatory I used to play in jazz band references. But the fact that he's a jazz guy and he scolds him for being a folk singer.
Oh, yeah.
Just one of the great in jokes there that the music aspect of this movie gets right, where he's like, you know, we play all 12 notes in a scale, not just G and C, which is dead on for a lot of folk songs. So I did really love that touch. And there are those great other little touches like that that can go by you if you're not really paying attention with the Garrett Hedlund character. Doesn't talk, smokes cigarettes. There's a scene where Oscar Isaac says to him, "Can I bum a cigarette?" And he says, "I'm out." That's all he says. And then a few minutes later,
What's he doing in the car?
And it just, they start on Oscar Isaac, and he's just looking at Garrett Hedlund, and then they cut to Hedlund, and he's smoking a cigarette. He just looks at him.
He earns his disdain there.
He does. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
All right, so your movie of the year, do you have room for a little quibble or a question? I wish they had done more with Carey Mulligan, both with the character and because she's so good. I just, right at the end there, things were getting interesting,
yeah,
and she's gone. And I think that's okay for this story. It's just an area where I had wanted more. I compare it to one of my top 10 films, The Spectacular Now, which one of the criticisms was Shailene Woodley being in that picture, but not enough. It was not serviceable to her story.
Right.
And I felt a little bit of that here, maybe because Mulligan's first couple of scenes are so harsh, and they're
so
supposed
harsh
to be. And then we start to see another side of her that's really interesting, and then she's gone.
Yeah. Well, that's where I could point you to my notes, Josh, where it says, problem. Gene is shrill.
Is that how you write them? You have a problem?
I wrote problem.
Column,
no, I did.
Okay,
for this movie, I just have so many random thoughts that I had to categorize them under subheadings. And
okay,
the only thing I have under problem,
just one thing,
is, yeah, truly, that was it. I think you could make the case, and I'm sure some people have, that the Carey Mulligan character is not, quote-unquote, strong enough. And that's something a lot of critics focus on with movies that have female characters. Maybe we're trying to compensate for the fact that, you know, we don't want it to appear as if we're not enlightened enough to look at these characters on screen.
No, I'm not criticizing them for not, I guess, very few Coen Brothers pictures. Fargo is obviously the example, have roles for women as good as the roles for men. Let's just put it that way.
That's
part of the way they make films.
Yeah.
And that is, they're right. It stood out to me, I think, mainly because she's so good. And it's almost works against you. If one of your strengths is not always women characters, maybe you don't want to cast someone like Mulligan, because she's just going to make that a little bit more glaring if the reins seem to be held back on her.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I guess where I was going was, it's very simple to say that this is not a strong female character. But really, more than that, what it is she's just not a nuanced female character. She does come off as very harsh. She's always angry at Llewyn Davis. She's always barking at him. And so when later in the film, you do get her anger coming through, certainly, but you also see that she's done something nice for him, that there is a part to her that clearly does love him on some level. You wish the movie gave you more of that. I do feel that way. That all said, there's a part of me, too, that just wants to look at it as, you know what, just as you noted that John Goodman is in this movie to be John Goodman and to serve a specific function during those scenes, does every single character, male or female, have to be a totally nuanced, fully realized character? And I would say maybe not, especially in a Coen Brothers movie. Her job is to be an instigator and to be someone who hates Llewyn Davis's character. And she serves a function in the story, and she serves it well. Would I have liked it to be ultimately more nuanced? Yes, I would have.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I was thinking as you were talking, is she is serving Goodman's purpose. I think that part called for a little more in the story that we're being told.
I can definitely see that. I do want to touch on the music a little bit more, because even though it goes a pretty decent portion of the movie without hearing Llewyn sing a song, there is a good chunk there in the middle. It's obviously so crucial to the story, and it's not just crucial because it's about music and about him as a performer, but because this whole notion of this larger battle, this larger question of his professionalism and his identity and selling out and being an artist, for that to work, it's sort of like her, right? For the concept of her to work, we have to believe that this operating system and this man could fall in love. Well, I have to believe that he's truly talented. I have to believe that not just talented, there is something in him, there's a spark that justifies or earns that disdain he has and he carries with him. And so, first of all, they struck brilliance, the Coen brothers did, by casting Oscar Isaac, who is just a great presence and a great actor. But they also found someone who can actually play the guitar and sing the songs. So there's no faking here going on at any point. And so that's why when you open the film with a scene that is almost an unbroken take, but it cuts to the crowd a little bit too, that just shows him playing the guitar and singing, well, we need to see that. We need to see right away that there is something he's touched with. here that is true talent, but maybe even something beyond talent. And this is where I think about what you were saying about the other folk songs that are in the movie. They are good. They're catchy. I like them. I would listen to them. But what they have that his songs don't have is they do sort of all rely on hopeful, easy platitudes. They have choruses that are very catchy and allow a crowd to sing back to them, which they do at one point. Lewin's kind of looking around like, what's going on here? Am I missing this? And he is missing it, right? And his songs don't have that. His songs are much more world-weary. They are sadder. They're stories. They aren't these, again, just kind of easily constructed ABC. We'll go back to the chorus here. They don't have that. And so, as I said, even though we're not necessarily judging, we do see how Lewin judges them. And you get it because when he performs, you have those differences that I just said. But you also have, Josh, this element to his singing and to his guitar playing that does make him stand out from those other characters. All of those songs start out a certain way, and you feel as if they're going to fall into sort of a conventional folk song pattern. And they all melodically, and it's both in the playing again and in his voice, they all melodically go to places that you don't expect them to go.
When I go back to Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor. Come along and follow me. We'll go down to Galilee. Everybody, green, green, rock and roll, yeah. Promenade in green.
At every turn, there are surprises in the song. And I love that because it just does suggest, especially with his voice, it's kind of this very high, almost angelic kind of voice. It suggests to me that he is touched with some kind of grace, that there is something to him and what he has that these other people don't. Whether you like the songs as much or not, there's something he's doing, I'm just telling you, objectively speaking, musically, that's very different than what they're doing. And so then what the movie can pose to you is when a character like Lewin Davis has that spark, is touched with that grace, and is committed to living the life that he has to live with that burden, if you will, and yet he can't even make ends meet. Well, what kind of world is this then?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the question of, it's not commercial, the talent he has.
Right.
So how does this, and again, this is where it's a parallel for the Coens' career, is they have been one of those filmmaking miracles who have managed to have commercial success while retaining that spark. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all you have to do is point to the fact that No Country for Old Men was an Oscar winner.
Right.
I mean, what other filmmakers could make a movie like that successful? So they have what Lewin has and have managed to preserve it and allow it to grow into this amazing career. And that's rare. That's incredibly rare. I think it's interesting when you think about the songs he plays. How about the one he decides to play when he's before the Chicago producer? You know,
right.
This is his audition.
Yeah.
And the producer says,
Queen Jane.
Play me a song from your album. Does he play probably the least commercial song he could for that audition? But it speaks to what you're talking about. He believes that will showcase what's special about him. And it's just thrown right back in his face because that's not going to make money.
No, it's not. And that is a fantastic scene. And another one where the Coen brothers wisely just let the camera rest on Oscar Isaac. A few cuts away to F. Murray Abraham. But for the most part, they just let him perform. And we do see that throughout the movie in all these performance scenes, because to go back to another word I used a ton, and you did as well, I think, during our Her discussion, this notion of connecting. At one point, we hear, I think it's that character, the Bud Grossman character played by F. Murray Abraham, he says about the Troy Wilson character, the soldier,
he really connects with people.
Mm-hmm. He says he connects with people. Well, how does Oscar Isaac, how does Lewin Davis connect with people? There's a scene late in the film where he goes to perform for his father, who's in a rest home, basically, and is not even speaking. And that scene is so wonderful because you remember what recently happened before that and that whole notion of connecting with people and the people singing along with Troy and Jim and Jean at the Gaslight. And they don't do that with his songs. And you see how his father reacts to him or doesn't react to him. And the end result of that scene, how that scene all culminates.
Yeah.
And you say, did he connect with his father? I don't know. Maybe he did. Maybe he did, actually. He seems to, but he connects with him in a really kind of grim, depressing way.
What's important there also is the choice of song.
Yeah.
I think very much so. Let me ask you a question about the music, and it's one I don't have an answer to. I almost wonder if a movie like this has a supreme advantage over us who are initially open to it when the music is this integral to what's going on and is this good. It made me think about it because you mentioned in our top 10 show, Scott Tobias, The Dissolve, mentioned it, how the songs have just been replaying and replaying. And I'm not saying this is maybe an unfairness, but I wonder if we tend to... It almost makes me think, should every movie incorporate music this way? Because people are going to automatically be able to carry it with them longer and in closer ways than they can a film that does not have music. Does that make any sense?
It does, but on the flip side, there are some people, for whatever reason, are just going to have a total aversion to these songs. And so the movie
you
is
have
probably
to be open,
never...
You have to be open to this
The movie
type of
may
music.
Be something they can never connect with because of that, and they're not going to enjoy it. But I'm with you that the music is a huge, huge strength of this movie. I think for me, the other thing that kind of has emerged as I've thought about Inside Llewyn Davis is, and I think it's something you see throughout the Coen brothers' work, is there's a little bit of a sense of it being a riddle. I think a wonderful one, an accessible one. They're not doing anything to confuse you or really challenge you in that way. But I think even though it's so straightforward, there are enough little mysteries and little intrigues and references thrown in that it rewards going back and viewing it again and really kind of questioning and unpacking some
Certainly
of those
the
things.
Ending.
Certainly the ending, there's no doubt. And one of those structural choices like we talked about in terms of the temporal nature of the film. But I also love even just little things like, and I will be honest, this didn't fully jump out at me until I started seeing some of the trailers for the movie after I saw the movie, because I first saw this like a month ago now, is in the trailer, if you've seen the commercial on TV over and over again, there's a part where he calls the Gorfines, the house he was staying at. He has their cat, and he's talking to the secretary of Mr. Gorfine, Professor Gorfine, and he says, just tell him that Llewyn has the cat. And she's taking the message and she says, okay, Llewyn is the cat. Mm-hmm. And he goes, no, Llewyn has the cat. And you wonder if it's just one of those little in-jokes by the Coen brothers where they're saying, well, if you want to know what the cat's real purpose here is metaphorically or whatever, the character actually verbalizes
it.
We're going to spell it. It's not just miscommunication. Yeah. That's our way of slyly putting in that Llewyn is the cat here. There are those little elements that come through again and again. And I love going back, as I have now a second time, and playing with some of those and watching them and considering them. I talked about a few of those things that emerged, Mike's name and his death haunting this whole movie. But you can also look at things specifically about the passage of time. It seemed something, for whatever reason, that it could have been a throwaway line, but caught my ear right away. The first thing he says when he gets done performing in the opening scene is he says, that's a song that's never new and it never gets old. Mm-hmm. It's a folk song. And it's echoed later in the movie when he makes a significant decision about his life, something he's going to do differently. And he says, I'm going to try something new. And by that, I mean something old.
Right?
It's that same thing. There's this notion, I said continuum for lack of a better word, but this sense that with this music, which these songs, the death of Queen Jane goes back to like the 18th century or something. Fare Thee Well is an 18th century song. Like they're revitalizing these. They're bringing them back. So what's old is new again, and yet they're going to live on forever in some way. So there's a sense that time, and I think it goes back to that netherworld too, has either sort of stopped or everything's just connected in a way. And I think that does all tie back as well. Obviously, I'm thinking out loud here a little bit because I don't know how to tie it all in, but it gets back to that mortality question too. And so time, because what is mortality but you running out of time? And so you see throughout the movie all of this discussion about the future and how he doesn't think about the future. And people at multiple points try to hand him back his past. Remember, two different people try to hand him a box of his old stuff. And he says, I don't want that. I don't want that baggage. And we see how that plays in later in the story. Even the big set piece of the movie that a lot of people are now familiar with because it's been out online, the Justin Timberlake Please Mr. Kennedy song. It's all about don't shoot me into outer space. Mm-hmm. It's 1961. It's about this fear of the future, right? Like Flash Gordon boots and how am I going to fit in the capsule? And maybe I'm reaching too far here, but the fact that it's all about Mr. Kennedy, as a viewer now, you can't help but watch the film in 1961 and think, well, you know what? His time's up. Mm-hmm. You know, his time is coming to an end very soon.
I think the idea of timelessness also speaks to the theme of the struggling artist, because everything that Llewyn is experiencing, this is not something anyone who chooses to be an artist and really pursue it is ever going to figure out, how to be able to do this easily in a way that's going to earn them not only a bed every night, but maybe the same bed every night, their own apartment, you know, a place to lay their head. And this goes back to the, that's why these are the same songs. The people who maybe wrote or were first performing these songs were struggling in the same ways that Llewyn Davis is now. Yeah. And they're singing the same song. So it's this recurring artist struggle. And I've got to say that the struggling artist genre in terms of movies is not one that I easily embrace, because oftentimes it's so self-serving and just, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just can't get into
indulgent
it.
Or whatever. Indulgent. This isn't that.
Oh my goodness. No, this is completely different in terms of how it honors the authenticity of that struggle without being self-serving in any way.
Yeah. And I think it does all crystallize in that scene where he is at dinner with the Gorfines and he is basically pleaded with to sing a song and perform, and he doesn't want to because it gets back to this idea of professionalism, and this is something he does for a living, and they're literally making him sing for his supper is what they're doing, right? He's going to get a free meal, but he's going to perform for them, and he says something about being a trained monkey or whatever. And then on top of it, this is where that great sort of empathy and that emotion comes through in this film, is when Mrs. Gorfine then starts singing Mike's part.
Right. There's a line that's crossed.
There's a line
in
that's
his
crossed.
Mind.
It was bad enough that he was having to perform for them like that trained monkey. But then when the death of his partner is invoked one more time, you completely understand his frustration. I think there is a sense watching it that you think, wow, he's really overreacting. How big of a deal is this? How rude
he
is.
You get it, but it's a bargain he's made too.
Yeah.
I mean, when we first meet him, he's waking up in their house and he's clearly making sure they're gone before he comes out, because he's just there for the bed and the food is the sense you get it. So it's this unholy bargain they've made with each other that kind of falls apart at that dinner scene.
Yeah. And speaking of that bed, here's my other reach that jumped out to me this time. When he goes and sleeps on the couch of Al Cody, which I'm forgetting the actor's name, Adam Driver, I think. He's from Girls, is where a lot of people recognize him and where I first saw him. He is a performer. He ends up staying on his couch for a night or two. When he goes, this goes back to my whole death thing with this movie. When he goes to his couch, he tests it out. And when he tests it out, he literally gets completely in between the head and the foot. And he gets really cozy.
It's his coffin, huh?
It's his coffin. It's his coffin. That couch.
He's happy
is his
to be
coffin.
There.
Well, it's all he's got. That's all he's got to face. That's all we all have to face, Josh, is death.
All right, take it easy.
Josh, this was fun. We'll see you after the break. I think our next show actually is the live show.
Talk about wanting to get in a coffin.
Oh, man.
Let the panic begin.
Whose idea was that? For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.